Welcome to the final addendum of the Undisclosed Podcast in the State versus Rocky Myers series. This is Colin Miller, one of the principals of the Undisclosed Podcast, and today I'm serving as the host of the addendum, which will cover episodes 3 and 4 of the Rocky Myers series. In episode 3 of the series, we explored the question whether the lack of physical evidence connecting Rocky to the crime scene makes sense given his skin condition and the use of judicial override in Rocky's case. And then finally, in episode 4, we discuss Rocky Myers' intellectual disability and his inability to argue that it should preclude his execution because he was abandoned by his appellate counsel. I'm joined today by two guests. The first is Casey Keaton. Casey graduated with her bachelor's degree in journalism from Mississippi University for Women. She received her law degree from the University of Alabama. While there, she received the ACLU Award for her work on an appeal for a death row inmate. In 2017, she received the Distinguished Alumni Achievement Award from MUW. Casey is on the leadership team of Faith in Action Alabama and volunteers with the Alabama Post-Conviction Relief Project. Casey and a coworker have been organizing and hosting storyteller events in the Montgomery community to highlight issues in the criminal justice system. These events are geared toward energizing community conversations about problems and solutions in the areas of concern within our justice system, such as mental health, mass incarceration, race, poverty, public defense, and the role of faith in our system. Casey, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Our second guest is a student here at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Haley Smith is a North Carolina native and a third-year law student here at the law school. She attended her undergraduate at American University in Washington, D.C., where she majored in political science with a minor in public administration and policy. While in law school, she developed an interest in criminal law and hopes to pursue a career in the area after graduating. Haley, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Now, Casey, of course, you're Rocky's attorney. Can you tell me how you first came to represent him?
I started representing Rocky when I actually first started at the Federal Defender's Office here in the Middle District of Alabama back in November of 2007. Our office had represented him prior to that, but I didn't come onto his case until I started at the office.
And so over all these years of interacting and working with Rocky, what can you tell our listeners about your impressions of him?
Rocky is probably... he's a special client to me. I've spent a lot of time with him at different points. And again, he was one of the first clients that I had here in the office. And pretty quickly after coming to the office, we were looking at having an evidentiary hearing on his equitable tolling issue. So it was also one of the first cases where I was out in the field doing interviews, meeting with family members, those kind of things. So definitely kind of stands out in a lot of ways for me. It's really the first time that I'd worked on a death penalty case, period. But as a person, he is such a nice guy. He is a client who is always thankful, who is always, just appreciative of any help. But he's also somebody who I know struggles and has taught me a lot more about communicating with a client and trying to break down information. But it's also taught me a lot because he's always so positive. Mm-hmm. And there are certainly times where has had stressful moments or some depression that he's had to deal with. But when he comes out the other side of that, it's one of the things that continues to amaze me that in the situation that he's in, a lot of times he is still thinks of himself as blessed because of family or because there are people that are on death row that have worse situations than him. So constantly trying to look on the positive side of things, which is amazing to me.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned a second ago that working with him has taught you a lot about communicating with clients. Can you go into a little bit more detail about what exactly that's taught you?
I think, I remember the first time I met with Rocky, and one of the people that had worked on his case previously had told me, he never eats anything during the visit with you. And because on Alabama's death row, you actually kind of sit down at a table with your client. They're not in shackles. You're sitting face to face with them, not through a glass. And so oftentimes we can buy sodas or sandwiches out of vending machines down there. And so when I got there, you know, I still have quarters for the visit, but I did not anticipate that he would be eating anything because of what other people had told me. But I asked him if he wanted anything, and he said, sure, if you, you know, if you just get me something. And what I kind of realized at that time, because I kind of handed him the bag of money, but that it was really like he didn't know how to work some of the machines there. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of this quick, you know, we make assumptions about clients sometimes or things that they, you know, and that's a simple one, but it really kind of, I think, reflects overall, we make assumptions about what clients understand or what they're taking away from something or what their opinion about something is because they either nod or express acceptance of something, but at the end of the day, they may be walking away with none of it. Rocky right. is a lot better now because of the length of time. You know, I've had him as a client now for 12 years. So a lot of times he now will be very comfortable and say, I don't understand any of that you just said to me.
yeah.
But I definitely, with other clients, I find myself taking a step back and trying to break something down into, you know, simpler sentences, choosing my words more carefully in explaining something because of my experiences with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Helly, as I said, you're a student here at the University of South Carolina School of Law. And it's kind of a neat story behind how you ended up working with me on this case and now appearing on this podcast episode. So what is that story behind you working on this case?
So I've been a fan of the podcast since I took your class. I think I took criminal adjudication first. Mm-hmm. So, took that last year and decided to start listening to the podcast and really enjoyed it. And so every year at the law school, we have a faculty auction where professors will bid items to do with them, such as be on this podcast, and other professors will do different things. And I had the ability to bid on to be on the podcast, and I was really excited because I'm such a big fan. And we actually set it up so that we could work on this case together over the summer. And so I would be doing some research and reading things related to the case, and then we would work this out so that I could be on it one of the episodes.
Yeah. And that auction you mentioned is an auction where we raise money so that students wanting to work in public interest jobs over the summer that don't pay money would have a stipend and be able to work in those jobs. And so, yeah, it's a really nice feature. And I was very glad to be able to work with you on this case. And so, you know, overall, with the time you've spent and the work you've done, what are your impressions and takes on the Rocky Myers case?
I feel there's so much that I could say because there was so much to read and so much to look through. I think that just there's so many moving parts in this case about, you know, there's so many different actors involved. And then you had a person that was arrested and then not arrested. And then Rocky came into the picture. So I think that trying to wrestle with all the testimony and the different, you know, lies people told over and over again when they were talking to the police and the second or third time they talked to the police. I think it was just astounding trying to keep up with all of that. And you've touched on this in other episodes, but just the lack of physical evidence tying into the crime and the only real base is the VCR. And I think it's just so interesting because there's just so many things going on here.
Yeah, and I mentioned in the introduction you wanting to pursue a career in criminal law. Has working on this case impacted your decision-making process about wanting to work in criminal law? And if so, maybe what particular job in criminal law you'd like to pursue?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that this is such good experience for me to really, you know, dig into the weeds of the testimony, to look at how things happen and these kind of trials. And I definitely had an interest going into law school doing criminal law, but taking the classes that I've taken and working on this project has definitely furthered that interest. I think I would like to be a public defender. I think I'd like to start doing that. I think that's a good job to have and really get my feet in the ground and do that. But I'd be up for anything working in the field, I think.
All parents know that parenting is no joke, and sometimes you find yourself saying things and telling your kids things you never thought you'd even have to say. Like, oh, for example, the first time my daughter, who was 8, saw her baby brother being diapered and took a good look and said, "What the heck is that? What is that inside his diaper?" I had to explain all about how boys are different. And goodness, you know, there's just never a day or week that goes by that there is so much stuff that you never thought you'd have to say. Well, our friends at Audioboom and Main Event Media have a brand new parenting podcast that they want us to share with you. On the new podcast, Never Thought I'd Say This, Fuller House star Jodi Sweetin and her best friend Celia Behar, a life coach, get together each week to recap the ridiculous in their parenting lives. Jodi and Celia hilariously tackle parenting taboos, interview other celebrity parents, and dive into the real issues that all parents face today on this brand new podcast. Fellow famous parents that will be on Never Thought I'd Say This include Christine Lakin from Step by Step, Melissa Gisoni from Maddie and Mackenzie Ziegler's Mom, and Andrea Barber from Full House and Netflix Fuller House. Never Thought I'd Say This is a co-production from Audioboom and Main Event Media and premieres Wednesday, July 10th with new episodes every single week. So be sure to search for and subscribe to Never Thought I'd Say This on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, Casey, going back to episode 3, that's when we discussed the use of judicial override in Rocky's case. And so from your work in the area, is Rocky's case the only one you've handled that's involved judicial override, or have there been other cases you've worked on that have also involved judicial override?
He is not the only judicial override case I have had. I have one currently that's still in federal court, and our office as a whole handles, we probably currently have about 6 or 7 clients of the approximate 32 that are still on Alabama's death row with override sentences. A year and a half ago, one of our clients that was a judicial override was executed.
What was his name?
Ron Smith.
And do you remember what the jury vote was in that case before the judge overrode?
It was not my case. I want to say that his was an 11-1 in favor of life.
Oh, wow. And do you know from, were there jurors who spoke in that case, or do you have an idea of what sort of the doubt was that maybe led to that vote in that case?
And there, it was that case, there was not a doubt. Okay. There was, you know, Ron had never contested that he had not committed the murder. I think it was more of a situational. We actually got an affidavit from a juror in that case who was really devastated from the process of having served as a juror and kind of the emotional toll that it took on her personally. And then to see, you know, their decision just kind of thrown out without any real, what she considered without any real consideration to why they came up with that decision.
Mm-hmm. And so, as you said, your office is handling a lot of these judicial override cases, and we had a bit of a discussion in the last episode about some appeals being made to override. So what is the current status of these appeals for your clients claiming the override is unconstitutional, and to what extent might that be able to help Rocky?
They're in a couple of different situations, depending on where they are in court. The one that I directly represent, we actually won in the 11th Circuit, not on the override issue, but on an Atkins issue. Mm-hmm. And we were sent back to federal district court, but for the whole petition, which means that our Hearst claim in that case is now back on the table. And we're actually in the process of hopefully filing a motion for summary judgment, arguing that we should just simply win on that. Rocky actually has a Hearst claim pending in state court where he's represented by another lawyer, but it is raising a successor Rule 32 or state post-conviction petition.
Okay. And when you say Hearst, so we have the Supreme Court opinion we mentioned in Hearst versus Florida, and that's sort of a Sixth Amendment jury right claim for relief. Do you know, is Rocky's claim just based upon the Sixth Amendment, or is it also, as we had in the episode partially based upon the Eighth Amendment and cruel and unusual punishment.
Rocky's, his successor petition is based on both the Sixth and Eighth Amendment. Yes.
Okay. And Haley, we actually, in the criminal adjudication class, I'm going to add it now, we didn't actually get to judicial override, but we did discuss how in every state other than Louisiana and Oregon, we're down to Oregon now, there has to be a unanimous jury verdict. And so what was sort of your impression from looking at this case and hearing the podcast about the fact that we have these people in death row in Alabama based on judicial override, and we still actually in Alabama allow for the death penalty, even if it's a non-unanimous verdict of 11-1 or 10-2?
I think that was really shocking for me at first when I started this, because I think one of the first things that we worked on is I went to the National Exonerations Registry and I looked at people in Alabama that were exonerated and whether judicial override played a part in that. And I think that there were a couple instances where it did. And looking more into it and what that is, I think I was really shocked by that. And I know at the federal level, you have to have a unanimous verdict. And I think it's surprising that at the state level that it's still allowed, that it can be non-unanimous. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure there's something pending before the Supreme Court about this. I'm not sure what the name of the case is, but hopefully this gets resolved because this is, it's such a big deal. You know, people's lives are on the line here. And the fact that a jury isn't completely unanimous in what they believe about whether they should be given life or death is, was hard for me to wrestle with in my mind.
Yeah, and Casey, I know that I've personally reached out and have been in talks with some representatives in Alabama about getting rid of the 10-2 or 11-1, allowing for the death penalty, as well as retroactively taking these override defendants off of death row. Do you have any hope that either of those ideas might get legislative traction in the next year or two?
I always have hope. I'm a criminal defense lawyer.
Well, in other words, when Alabama got rid of judicial override, is that a hopeful thing or more of a cynical reaction of, well, they saw Hearst and knew that that would be thrown out if they didn't do it themselves?
I think probably the answer is both, depending on the vote. I believe that some of the original sponsors of the bill have a real desire to see some criminal justice change in Alabama. One of the sponsors actually stated during the legislative hearings on it that he felt like it was truly a moral issue, that this was just simply wrong. And there was some discussion about even, you know, just the impact of on jurors from asking them to sit through what can be a really emotionally draining event. There's already obviously sitting through a murder trial can be pretty impactful, but the penalty phase can be even more so for multiple reasons. And then asking them to do that and then basically throwing out their decision after you've asked them to, you know, endure this. So I think there were definitely some of the people doing it because they thought it was the right thing to do. But I do think there was definitely some people who saw, who felt like they saw the writing on the wall. However, that has yet to play out actually in the courts in Alabama.
Right. And so then the other issue, Casey, that we discussed in episode 3 was this German study, as well as some more recent studies about African Americans and eczema. And that study in Germany found if you have eczema, you're exceedingly likely to leave behind DNA after touching objects. I think the number was 90%. And so from just interacting with Rocky in person at prison, how apparent has his eczema been?
It really depends. There are definitely kind of seasonal times where you see it. He also, for the first time in prison, has regularly had treatment in terms right. of skin lotions and medical creams, medication. So I think that probably in the time that I have represented him, I have not ever seen it as badly as he experienced it pre-prison. But I have seen it where there is clear flaking, particularly like in his scalp area. And, you know, elbows, kind of general areas where you may see it more significantly for people. experiencing eczema, but definitely in those areas, different times of the year, seasonally, seeing some pretty significant flaking.
Right. And Haley, you touched upon this a bit before when I asked about your impressions on the case, but how compelling do you find the fact that there's not any physical evidence tying Rocky to the crime scene as evidence of his possible innocence?
I think it's extremely compelling. I think that looking at that and then looking at all the different statements from the witnesses, you know, multiple of them lied and told different stories, and eyewitness recounts aren't even completely accurate. So I think that the lack of physical evidence, which is almost always accurate, can be, is, I think it proves his innocence in a way that is extremely compelling, and you would hope that that would be enough, but it wasn't in this case.
Yeah, and Casey, you know, we obviously had the podcast material and the interview with this German researcher, as well as this new study about African Americans and eczema, and we'll have to follow up with the experts. I know the German expert said she would give a report. Do you think there's a possibility in there that if we collect enough of this evidence about eczema and compare it against the crime scene, it could potentially be grounds for a claim of actual innocence?
You know, the actual innocence bar is such a high bar procedurally where we are for Rocky's case at this point. I would love to think that that it could make an opening, but I also have seen over and over again how just how hard those claims are, particularly at this point where he is out of court and having to carry the burden to be able to file a successor, either a successor 2254, a federal habeas, or a successor Rule 32.
Right. And then, Haley, the reason we're in this boat with Rocky being out of court and having to file a successor petition is what we covered in episode 4, which is Rocky being abandoned by his appellate counsel and losing his right to appeal because his attorney who was representing him never sent along this opinion denying relief. And so as just a student who hasn't had the chance to fully practice yet, how shocking was it for you to learn that under the circumstances of Rocky's case, he could lose his right to appeal based upon this factual scenario?
I think everything about this case truly does shock me about how that could happen, I think is one of the most shocking, because, you know, they preached us in law school and after taking our professional responsibility classes, you know, you have to keep up with your client is the most important, all of this, and the fact that this could happen and it could have reached this point where he didn't even assume that responsibility and just Rocky was hurt by it is awful. And I think it makes me going forward when I get into practice more aware of what I need to be doing and keeping up with all of these deadlines and be aware of them at all times.
Right. Casey, you know, the other part of the episode that we addressed in episode 4 dealt with Rocky's intellectual disability. And so can you discuss with our audience a bit what you get from Rocky regarding his intellectual disability and how you think it might have impacted this case?
In terms of my personal observations with Rocky in regard to intellectual disability, there are particular barriers that I have in representing him. I have clients who can write me letters and that I can write them and send them documents and then plan to just follow up, you know, maybe a little bit down the road when I actually, you know, have some free time to spend 4 hours, 4+ hours on the road to go to Holman. Rocky is somebody that cannot write me a letter. And I know that if I send him paperwork that he can't read it and understand it. So that's a clear observation for me. It also tells me a lot about how Rocky would have been with an attorney at trial or again during his Rule 32 process. he is in many ways totally dependent on the council who have promised to represent him. And he is also a little embarrassed oftentimes about what his limitations are. So if somebody is explaining something to him and they're not taking time to consistently follow up and ask, did you understand this? Can you explain it back to me? Things like that, they're not going to get that he didn't get it. And he's not going to correct them most of the time, particularly if it's somebody that he's not comfortable with. And I think that Rocky very naively thought that because he was not guilty, that it was going to work out, you know, that he was never going to be found guilty because he wasn't guilty. Right. And I think that's kind of, you know, some simplistic thinking evident there. In terms of how it impacted his case, I think it absolutely impacted every moment of his interaction with his counsel. And I think it impacted particularly at the state post-conviction level, it impacted how he proceeded in that he was dependent on Mr. Schwartz. And when Mr. Schwartz failed him, he had no other ideas that he should be doing anything else because right. he can't read other than, again, at a third, fourth grade level. Writing is something, again, that he's doing at about second, third grade level. So the idea that he could have kept up with his case and understood what was going on and known that an attorney was going to just drop the ball so completely escapes my ability to understand why any courts would think that.
Right. And one of the things we didn't have the time to address in the episodes, but I thought was interesting that I think we had discussed earlier, is that based upon Rocky's intellectual disability, he has difficulties with keeping time or understanding what time it is. And I think you expressed to me before that might have also played a role in his police interrogation and just being able to account for his activities on the day of the murder, right?
Absolutely. You know, again, because obviously Rocky was not the first person arrested for this crime. When he came in when he was being questioned, this was a month plus out from the time, and they were asking him to account for where he was on a particular night and when something happened and what were the course of the events for that day. And that's something that Rocky significantly struggles with. You know, his ex-wife, who he was still married to at the time of the offense, talked significantly about she was the person who kept up their calendar in terms of when anything was due, your bills she was totally responsible for, job applications she was doing, reminding him when he had an interview or when he was supposed to be at a particular place at a particular time. She was the one who was doing all of that. And before he was married, it was his mama. So this is something that is definitely not something that he was used to doing. And certainly when you're talking about asking him to think back to that particular time, I just think that it's not a person of average intellect would struggle with that. And somebody who has the difficulties that Rocky has, I think that's doubly so.
Right. And there were, as far as I can tell, right, at the guilt innocence phase of trial, there was no reference to Rocky's intellectual disability.
Correct. There was none.
Right. And so, Haley, you know, wrapping up with you, is there anything else from your work on this case that you found interesting that maybe we didn't have time to address in the podcast?
I think there are just so many things, but I think just after reading the testimony, the biggest mystery to me is still Angela Acklin. I think that her not showing up for the trial and then whatever was going on with her, her dress was ripped and all of that. I thought that was very strange, and I still haven't completely been able to understand that in my mind. And then I think, of course, oh, Tyrone's timeline makes absolutely no sense. And, you know, the people that claim that they saw him, well, their times don't even match up with each other and don't match up with when he was released, his son was released from the hospital. So I think those two things really stood out to me the most, but I think everything is very interesting in this case.
Yeah, and so Casey, Haley mentioned Angela Acklin. We didn't touch upon it too much in the podcast, but I think you sent along to me, right, that there have been interviews with Angela after trial, and she sticks to her claim about seeing Anthony Quilbrey's Ballantyne with a bloody shirt in the vicinity of Lydia Mae Tucker's house and then the murder, right?
Yes.
Yeah, and so we have that, and not in the audio, but just sort of written statements that people took, yeah. And so, Casey, you know, in terms of the case and our presentation on the podcast, is there anything we didn't get to on the podcast that you think might be important or that you want to discuss about Rocky's case?
I really think that y'all have done such a good job covering so many of the things that have been difficult for us to really understand how some things happen. So I don't know that there's anything that stands out to me in terms of what was not covered in any way. I think you've definitely hit the high points that we've tried to impress on people for a long time now.
Okay. And so then finally, Casey, before we get to the listener questions, what can our listeners do, if anything, at this point to help Rocky in his case?
I think the we are not at a stage where we have an execution date currently, thank goodness. We have been at one previously, which is when we really started a lot of our clemency work before, but we were able to get a stay of that prior date. So at this time, we have not presented a clemency petition to the governor, but the ACLU website does have a petition that people can sign. Obviously, sharing about Rocky's case, sharing this podcast on social media, things like that, continuing to keep people talking about Rocky and the miscarriage of justice that I think has happened in his case, I think is incredibly important.
Okay, well, let's turn to the social media questions then. The first of those comes from River Daughter, and her Twitter handle is @WonderlustLost. And she asks, can a lawyer please explain to me how the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act isn't unconstitutional when it bars the actually innocent from seeking relief after a miscarriage of justice? Again, because I still don't get it. And so, Casey, basically this AEDPA does a few things, including raising the burden of proof for getting relief, having the one-year time limit for bringing an appeal from a state denial of relief. And then in Rocky's case, when obviously he's been abandoned by state appellate counsel, he now can't bring an appeal in federal court. Is there a good reason that the AEDPA has been upheld, or is there a strong argument it's unconstitutional?
There are certainly people that make arguments that the AEDPA is unconstitutional. Nobody's won on any of those yet. And it doesn't, it doesn't expressly bar those claims, but it certainly raises a lot of procedural hurdles to pursue those claims. And, you know, I think there's a lot of it that people who practice day in and day out in federal habeas still wonder why and don't get some of the things that happen, certainly. There is a miscarriage of justice exception for cases, but again, it's a really narrow route to overcome that, and so it makes it difficult to surpass for people. I think one of the things, there's a case, and I cannot remember the name of it, where they talk about the miscarriage of justice standard is consistent with the AEDPA's concern that the merits of concluded proceedings not be revisited. In other words, that we raise the importance of finality frankly, above some criminal rights, with the exception of in a strong showing of actual innocence. But then you know, former justice, deceased Justice Scalia, specifically said in a dissent that the court has never held that the Constitution forbids the execution of a convicted defendant who has had a full and fair trial, but is later able to convince a habeas court that he's actually innocent. Basically saying that, you know, the Supreme Court has never said that it's unconstitutional to execute an innocent person, in my opinion. So that's kind of the framework we're working within in these cases. So yeah. I don't know that that answers that question at all, yeah. But.
Well, I think you hit upon the key point there, which is that position by Justice Scalia seems to stand today. We had Julie Seaman with the Georgia Innocence Project on a previous season, and she had written, I think, an editorial for the New York Times, When Innocence Isn't Enough, and it sort of is underscoring the same point you just made, where the Supreme Court is so concerned with finality and innocence sometimes isn't enough. And yeah, the question that often gets raised is, are we elevating procedure over substance, namely substantive innocence? And I think there is a great argument the ADPA is unconstitutional. The question is whether in our lifetimes that'll actually be a court ruling or a legislative overrule. Our second question was from Renee Mason, and she asked whether the clips we heard from Dr. Treble on the episode were her testifying on behalf of Rocky Myers. And Casey, the answer is no, right? This was for a clemency video you made for not Governor Ivey, the current governor, but for the prior governor, right?
Correct. Yes, those were when we put together the clemency video is when we had Dr. Treble. We videoed her, and it was me in response to questions that I asked her.
Right. And Dr. Treble, if I'm correct, I think I'm right, has never actually had a chance to testify in court on behalf of Rocky. It's just this informal video that you have done, right?
Correct.
Right. And again, the reason for that is, if Rocky were not abandoned by his appellate counsel, he would have had a full Atkins hearing and had experts coming in and testifying. You mentioned this before, and we touched upon it in the podcast. The only way this came up was sort of collaterally when you were asking for what's known as equitable tolling, right?
Yes. We've never had a full Atkins hearing. Obviously, his intellectual deficits were discussed in regard to the equitable tolling, but never a full Atkins hearing.
Right. And that also feeds into our last comment, which is by Liz Rudisill, another comment on social media. And she asked about Dr. Treble, the Alabama professor, not citing to the most recent version of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And Casey, again, that's because what she did was it 2013 or 2014? It was a few years ago, so it wouldn't have been the most recent manual. It would have been the prior one, right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, anything else that either of the two of you wants to share before we wrap up?
The only thing that I want to say is that, you know, I want to thank y'all for highlighting Rocky's case in this. I talked to him on the phone yesterday, and I think he is constantly amazed that people who do not know him and who are not related to him care about his case and about what's happened to him. And it means so much to him and to myself and Sarah and other people who have been involved on his case. It is incredibly a morale boost in seeing other people interested in his case, but actually going so far as to ask what they can do to help is amazing to me. And I really appreciate that. But I also want you to know how much it means to Rocky.
Well, thanks. And, you know, we certainly appreciate all the hard ground level work that people like yourself and Sarah have done on Rocky's case. And we just enjoy the privilege of being able to work with you and share this with an audience who is very interested in these issues and hopefully can help Rocky in some way before it's too late. And so, listeners, again, we will post it on social media. There's a current petition by the ACLU where you can ask for clemency for Rocky. And then, you know, knock wood that it doesn't get to it, but if it gets to a point where an execution date is scheduled, we'll certainly be making a call to you to assist Rocky in other ways. So Casey and Haley, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. I appreciated having you on, and thank you so much. thanks so much for listening to this special addendum episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Baluki for our logo, Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for theme music, and Mital Talhan, our executive producer. And as always, you can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.